Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for my podcast, Great New American Essays. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's spotlight is on the literary magazine, The Iowa Review. I'm joined by the magazine's editor, Lynn Nugent. Her chapbook of essays on motherhood and domesticity was published by the Florida Review in 2020 after winning a chapbook contest. She holds an MFA in nonfiction writing and a PhD in English from the University of Iowa. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Absolutely. So let's give us a bit of a sense, lay the groundwork, if you would, for the Iowa Review, when it was founded, its mission, what maybe differentiates it a bit from other magazines out there.
Yeah. So the Iowa Review was founded in 1970, and it's located at the University of Iowa. And so what I think distinguishes it is that it benefits from being amid this amazing community of writers and readers that exists here in Iowa City. So there's always been faculty, staff from the various writing programs and departments here. Students have been sort of the backbone of our first readers ever since the beginning. And so I think it keeps it exciting and fresh because students are always evolving in their tastes and discovering new things. And so I think it keeps us kind of like youthful and up to the moment in the selections that are made for the magazine, rather than if it were just me, you know, middle-aged person, it might get kind of stagnant. But I think it's the mix of people that's always made it so exciting.
Good. So you're telling me, in other words, Iowa City has more than Caitlin Clark, the basketball phenom.
Well, of course, we all love Caitlin Clark so much, but I'm sure with all the writers that there are in Iowa City as well, there are people probably writing poems in her honor as we speak. But yes, we're all very excited about the basketball history that's being made here right now.
Well, a cousin of mine, her partner, was the first women's basketball coach at the University of Iowa. And they left Denver and actually rented an apartment for 3 months in Iowa City just to witness the season.
Oh my gosh, that is so cool. That is a great thing to hear.
That's commitment.
I'm completely not surprised at all that, you know, that would be happening for sure.
But let's turn it back to the essay form as opposed to women's basketball. So when you became editor, you included this note in the spring 2023 issue. So when I became editor, I realized that including a diversity of voices was my main priority for the magazine. Can you illuminate for readers kind of what's helping to drive that? Is it just those fresh voices you mentioned in the community? Is it demographics? Is it whatever you want to take it to?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're lucky in that the staff we've had drawing from the current students at the University of Iowa have been a very diverse group of people. So that's something that we benefit from. And so we have the opportunity to have all these different people with different viewpoints reading the submissions. And I think that it draws in many more voices. And I think I might have put in that same editor's note that the very first issue of the Iowa Review was all white men, you know, as sure. You know, you would expect from something that's a product of its time, 1970. And so I think we're always, though, kind of fighting that tradition of literary magazines as being considered something that's exclusive, elitist, that people may not feel invited to be a part of. And so sure, that's just always something to be aware of.
Okay. So speaking of being invited and so forth, you were just at the AWP annual conference, which has grown to be quite a mega event. What's your insider's guide to how to survive and make the most out of the AWP conference.
Okay. My main advice is, this advice has been honed over many years. Don't try to do too much. Don't be like me when I first started going to AWP, because you'll be completely exhausted and burned out after the first day. And even more so post-pandemic, because I think that a lot of us, especially writers, are not used to socializing anymore. And so you spend the whole first day talking, and then you've lost your voice, and you just have to lie down the rest of the time. So I would say definitely pace yourself, because there are a lot of things that seem so exciting, and just reading upon reading to attend. And but also you should remember to eat and rest.
fair enough. So you sent me three issues, and I chose a particular essay out of each one. The first one, coming from the summer 2022 issue, is Jonathan Way's essay, Why I Lie. Now, I happen to mention to you that I grew up in Northfield, Minnesota. Jonathan's older brother was on the soccer team that I created and got passed by the school board. I'm sure himself was on the team, but being a bit younger, I didn't know him nearly as well as his older brother. So, when I opened the table of contents, I went, well, I think I'm going to be looking at this essay for sure. Tell me a bit more about it than what I've mentioned so far.
Okay. First of all, small world, Northfield, yes. Minnesota, you know, go figure. But yes. So this essay really stood out to us because it's kind of a masterclass in a good essay, because it starts out really grippingly, and it's going to eventually talk about something that happened when the narrator was 13. But instead of saying when I was 13 and then going from there, it starts with a bunch of declarative statements that turn out to be lies. So, it starts out, I'm Chinese, and then it's in parentheses, I'm half. And then it goes, I'm 5. And then in parentheses, I was 4. I caught a big fish. I didn't steal that cookie, that candy, that money. So it's this list of lies that he's told. And so as the reader, you're immediately drawn in to identify with this narrator and not be able to push off, okay, well, this is an experience that someone had, in Northfield, Minnesota in 1977. This person, this narrator is coming out and saying, I'm a liar. And I think we can all, to some extent, we've all maybe thought that, or, reflected on that experience of lying or being lied to. And so we identify more with the dilemma that this essayist is working through.
Yeah, I was saying, back, aren't we all probably fallible narrators in life, including our own tale? Yes.
Oh, definitely. And in the genre of nonfiction, where whether something is true or not is always kind of top of mind, to play with that, that line between truth and lying and reliability and unreliability is pretty sort of exciting and destabilizing for the reader.
Yeah. And he's got a contrast also now between the declarative statements and the lies, or the modifications, as it were. But also, he's come to Northfield from Staunton, Virginia, where the hostility to him on a racial basis was even stronger. Although I must say, on behalf of Northfield, I was disappointed that we apparently were more hospitable than I would have liked to have imagined. But so these things go sometimes.
Yes, definitely. Yes, he moves to Minnesota and has these experiences there. And not to give spoilers, but you are kind of left, wondering what's true, just like you are with those first declarative sentences where you're thinking, okay, what's a lie? What's true? I'm not really sure yet. And so, yeah, it's a great way to leaving you on that edge of between knowing and not knowing. It's a great way for Jonathan to explore why these lies have sort of like come out of his mouth in these sort of pivotal moments in his life.
Sure. But the one definitive lie from his, the way in which it's embedded is the Pledge of Allegiance, which appears much later in the essay. So whatever the other obfuscations, that is a major case from his vantage point of something that's not nearly as true as it might have appeared to be.
Right. And it really widens the scope because, I mean, we're all implicated at some point. He says he has a great line about feeling shame that he's not bigger than racism in America. And I mean, I think we're all in that boat, you know, we're all struggling with that legacy of racism and feeling shame about it. And so I think the question for Jonathan Wei was, you know, what do you do about it? Do you become part of the making these myths and creating these lies about the U.S. and what it is? Or do you start telling the truth?
Sure. And then you mentioned earlier what, the first issue of Iowa Review looked like in 1970, which is very similar to when Tom Wolfe put out the, I believe it was 1974 first edition of New Journalism, which had merely two women writers out of 22 or 24. But here he says, regarding Cheever, Updike, DeLillo, he says, white dudes doing white shit in white neighborhoods, they aren't writing about America. That seemed to me, along with the whole question about what's the truth, to be one of the most essential lines in the essay.
Yes. And what window are we looking through at, you know, or what voices are we trusting to tell the story of America? And should we be questioning that? And yeah, I really like in that line also the tone that he strikes, which he does throughout the essay, which is being sort of funny and casual while also talking about really serious things at the same time.
Yeah, funny and incisive both. Yeah, there's real stakes involved. Let's move to the winter 22-23 issue. I had chosen one called Rat Beach. This is by Elizabeth Hall. I'm sitting here today in California, sometimes referred to as the Golden State, even though I'm from Northfield originally. It certainly paints a very different picture of California than Hollywood would have us imagine in many cases. Tell us a bit about the essay, and I might chime in here or there with a comment or two.
Yes, I'm seeing a through line of geography in your selections. There's the geography of your youth and geography of your current day, although I don't know if you're in Northern or Southern California.
So
I don't know if you've seen any rats today, but this essay is about someone who sees quite a few of them in her daily life. And yeah, I think, you know, it's just with this one, the texture of the details created this very immersive feeling for me of, okay, you know, young person in a precarious financial situation, roommate problems, this whole picture of a life in which the person is feeling rather desperate. And so this mix comes what she thinks could be a rat in her ceiling. And that kind of puts her on the path towards researching what these California rats are like. You know, you hear about them cliched as being, you know, like part of the New York scene, but then there's this whole strain of rats that are dominant in Southern California. And like you say, the idea of paradise gets sort of punctured the more she goes down this road of learning more about them.
Yeah, no, there's a line at one point she says, in bed, stiff as a matchstick, I watch the hours die. I once was living in a house that had some mice, not rats, fortunately, running around in the ceiling before they got exterminated. And it was pretty unsettling. You go to bed and they're kind of like in full mode. It's hard to fall asleep.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to fall asleep.
I mean, every room, seems so much smaller if you start hearing something running around in the walls, definitely.
Yeah, no, I was once at the Sturgis Biker Rally, and they had a contest, and it was called the Rats Hole, and it was in honor of the person who was sponsoring the event based on an apartment he had once rented that he nicknamed the Rats Hole, because maybe that wasn't a rat, but it was just a horrible, unfortunate place. A different essay. I'm not sure geography will play here, but maybe it does. Bloodlust. It's an excerpt by a memoir by Libby Kurtz, and she's working as a U.S. Air Force Hospital Trauma Center nurse. And this is really a striking piece of writing. It's the stakes couldn't be higher for people's lives, but the descriptions are so vivid. I imagine when this came in, you must have gone, oh my God, hands shaking on encountering it.
Yeah. And even, I mean, it is a very gripping hospital drama for part of it. And then
for part of it, yes,
the next
you're right.
It's actually kind of two separate parts of the memoir or two separate chapters, but they were both so good that even though they don't create one piece together, we just had to include them both. Very different, but both equally sort of exciting, because in the second one, even though it's not the hospital drama piece where someone's life is on the line, you do see this young woman who's in an Air Force recruiter's office. And in a way, her life is on the line because she's figuring out what to do and whether to sign up with the Air Force. But this, yeah, and I'm excited to see, you know, if this whole memoir comes out, I will definitely pick it up and read everything, because I am completely invested in this writer's journey based on these two short pieces.
Yeah, the second part I found very intriguing, because to me it was all like, yeah, now her psyche's on the line. And, you know, it turns out, if I read it correctly, and I went back over some parts of it, that the grandfather, who was a military veteran, had unfortunately engaged in some abuse, and yet she still wants to join the military as opposed to walking away from it. So it seems to me like there's a lot of tension around that. I don't know if you can speak to that.
Definitely. I mean, when I read it, I had to read it again as well, thinking, oh my gosh, if you had had this experience of this horrible person in your life, why would you want to follow the career path of this
yes.
horrible person? Wouldn't you want to do the exact opposite? But I think, yeah, I think with great essays, they do surprise you in that way and defy your expectations and make you realize something about yourself as well. Like, you know, times in your own life where you've done things that may seem irrational or paradoxical.
Yeah, well, going back to Jonathan Wayes, it seems like there's a certain strange pledge of allegiance going on here to a family tradition of doing this, despite the grandfather really violating what should be his, to my mind, his oath, you know, as one's father figure or grandfather figure. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. And I mean, in Jonathan Wayes' piece, he talks about that. We didn't even mention the quotes from Pavlov and the experiments
True.
In which, you know, dogs were, they're conditioned to react in a certain way. And so by the end, you sort of realize, oh, this pledge of allegiance is this thing that, yeah, has maybe conditioned us all in part, as well as everything else about American culture, to respond in certain ways to certain situations. And yeah, in Libby Kurtz's piece, you can see that as well, that there is a bunch of conditioning there, even though your rational mind might be saying, wait a minute, this is not right, and I'm not going to do this, but then you sort of do it anyway.
Yeah, well, it's you know, the physicality doesn't end, of course, in the operating room. It's also that she talks about, you know, her body, and she says, you know, my breast milk soured inside my bra. I mean, that's the sort of detail you obviously are not going to get from a male writer in 1970, nor from a grandfather. So it's part of, you know, a unique voice that's coming out here in that setting. I don't think we hear from nurses a great deal. They're a large part of the workforce. They're instrumental to health services, but I don't think we get their voice very often. And in a literary magazine, it was it's a tough piece, but it's a good piece, very good piece. But it was a real surprise to encounter it, in this setting. I mean, I just don't come across those voices very often.
I'm glad you liked it. Yeah, the way she draws the parallel between it being a new mother, having to go pump her milk at work, and being back at work at the hospital where, you know, people's bodies are failing. And then, yeah, just feeling just kind of very dissociated from her own body was really, what a unique situation to be describing to all of us.
Yeah, she said at one point, my breasts felt like metal grenades strapped to my chest. That is certainly a memorable line, as is an earlier line talking about the anesthesiologist surrounded the patient's upper body like a pit crew serving a race car. Those are certainly the kinds of lines that make a piece sing.
Definitely. Well,
yeah.
100% agree.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much, Tom, for your time, Lynn. This has been Great New American Essays. Our focus this time on the Iowa Review. I had the pleasure of having its editor, Lynn Nugent, with me. Thank you, Lynn, for your time, and thank everybody else.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.